The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, today, Harold James. This is a person that you've wanted to have on a number of times in the past, but actually it ties right in with our comments that we talked about with Otmar Issing, the architect of the euro, last week.
I have thoroughly enjoyed both books that I've read by Harold James, The End of Globalization, which was written about 10 years ago, Lessons from the Great Depression, and then a book written just this last year called The Creation and Destruction of Value.
David, you would never know that he wrote that book last year. That book is completely dog-eared. I'm looking at you holding your copy right now, and I mean, it looks like that book's 10 years old.
To be honest, this is one of the first times I've encountered my father in myself. There's, you know, when the whole book is underlined,
right.
That's a Don McIlvaney book.
Yeah.
What was unimportant? That's why I chose to read the book. No, seriously, Kevin, Harold James, he's a professor of history and international affairs at Princeton University and has published far more than these two books, both in articles and in longer form. We wanted to have him as a part of the conversation because he brings light to the globalization cycle and brings into focus the globalization cycle, which the European Central Bank, remember our conversation last week with Otmar Issing, in the role that central banking and monetary policy has played in the current context. But what Harold James does is he looks back at the last 100 years or more and puts it in historic context.
Well, and, you know, not just that. This is a person who he sees the advantages to globalization, but he says all periods of globalization have ended with contagious financial crisis and ultimately war, which ties right in, David, with the things you've been talking about for the last couple of years, where we go from the financial to the economic to the political and then, unfortunately, to the geopolitical or the strategic war type of effort.
Well, I think that's why when I came across his book, there was an overlap in my thinking in terms of the direction that we're headed towards political and geopolitical crisis. And so in reading the book, it certainly filled out a historic perspective for that. And I think it's an invaluable read. I would encourage any listener to order a copy of The Creation and Destruction of Value. Like any book we read, there are things that you agree with, things that you disagree with, and that's fine. There's so much to learn if you're cataloging and looking through it with discernment. What I'd like to say, Kevin, today is that we have in the news Citigroup reporting surprising earnings of $4.4 billion for the first quarter. Goldman Sachs reporting $3.46 billion in earnings for the first quarter.
It's amazing that Goldman Sachs is making money. I guess they always make money, don't they?
Well, yeah. Whether they're long the market, short the market, whether they're helping their clients,
or
hurting their clients.
Or front-running the market.
I think the reason this relates as a headline into what we're talking about today is the end of globalization and the destruction of value comes with a breaking of trust.
Yeah.
And the breaking of trust started 10 years ago with the aha, I got you, when WorldCom and Enron were cooking the books. Ultimately, I think we're going to find a lot more people have been cooking the books. But here we have in the last few weeks the saga of Goldman Sachs literally taking their clients to the cleaners.
Right.
Now, granted, we don't want to try them in anywhere but the courts, but it is certainly indicative of a Wall Street trend that's been in place for 120 years plus. If you can get away with it, by all means do.
Right.
That's certainly not our ethic, but Wall Street carries it to an extreme, and it's about to bring about a radical reintroduction of political reform that will impact Wall Street dramatically, because now it is the man in the street, even though in this case it was institutions and well-informed investors, but it is still enough of a motive to get the legislation passed.
You know, David, you talk about how we've had the need for regulation in the past, but the problem is the regulations and the transparency is different than what actually Wall Street and Washington right now are pushing. Wall Street is still going on with the lack of transparency. Washington's pushing a gigantic financial regulation bill that doesn't necessarily solve the problem, but it sure gets politics involved in areas that it shouldn't play, right?
Well, I agree with you, Kevin. The other problem is that many of the politicians in office today understand very little about the financial markets and even less about economics. And the danger is when you start putting reforms into markets that you really don't understand, the possibility of an entire meltdown within the market is heightened.
Yeah.
The probabilities rise. Why? Because as we've discussed with Richard Buchstaber, we have this tightly coupled system in which when you change even the minutest variables, you can throw things out of control. And so we now have the justification for radical reform.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, will that reform on the surface there to help us, will it in fact have unintended consequences? We will watch and wait with great curiosity. Until then, we do want some historical perspective. And again, Harold James, we thank you for joining us on the line today from Florence, Italy. I want to start with reading a section from your book as an introduction to our conversation today. Financial crises are the catalyst for turning the globalization cycle. In such crises, assessments of the future, which form the basis of monetary valuations, change very quickly. An inability to put a correct price on an asset leads to the breakdown of markets and the erosion of confidence. Banks, businesses, and even individuals no longer trust each other. The effect on social cohesion is devastating. Collapsing values also have a spillover effect, which intensifies the process of disintegration. They fundamentally change immaterial values as well. Hence, the globalization collapse becomes a story of changing values in both the usual sense of the term as monetary and ideal values are shaken. I wanted to know if, getting started, you would just give us a brief definition of globalization and an overview of what the end of globalization, past and present, looks like.
Sure. It's a great pleasure to be with you. I've obviously thought about globalization a lot over the last 20 or 30 years. I think of globalization really as involving the exchange of things across national boundaries, across large geographical oceans. It's the exchange of money, it's the exchange of goods, it's the movement of people, movement of ideas, and all of those areas are interconnected with each other. And when you start to chip away at one of those interconnecting aspects, all the other aspects of mobility, all the other aspects of interconnection start to change.
Well, again, going to your book, you say that in practice, a globalization of goods, capital, and people often leads to a globalization of violence. And as I read Niall Ferguson's book, War of the World, this concept was clarified for me, you know, where the violence of the last century is related to financial change, whether it's positive or negative. You point out that as almost every period of globalization came to an end, there was a war. Is this, in your opinion, a high probability outcome?
I think it's right historically that most previous phases of globalization collapsed with dramatic military conflict. You know, I go back really quite a long way, as I think Neil Ferguson does, and think of something like the Roman Empire as an early experiment in globalization, or China in the 10th, 11th, 12th century as an experiment of globalization. And indeed, those stories did collapse with war. And I think most recently, a lot of historians now have paid attention to this, the 19th century, which holds out a kind of template or a model for our era of globalization, really was substantially shocked in 1914 when the big European countries of Europe went to war with each other. I wonder which it is really that's most destructive, war, financial crisis, though they're connected with each other. And in a sense, in the 19th century example, the First World War was this dramatic shock, but in the 1920s, people tried to put the story together again. And the dramatic collapse was really with the contagious financial crises in the early 1930s. So both war and financial crises are very, very destructive.
When that globalization cycle rolls over and there's a break in the trend, there's a profound disorientation or disillusionment which occurs with people. Is this the making for political or social upheaval? That's something that The Economist has pointed out and predicted for as a global trend for 2010. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I think people, when they see the world becoming more uncertain, they want some sort of protection against that uncertainty, and they look to much more local ways of protecting themselves. They look to existing states as a way of protecting themselves. They want to define themselves as citizens of one state rather than citizens of the world, or they define themselves as citizens of one state opposed to citizens of another state. So this looking for protection or certainty in the middle of the great upheaval, since the values are shifting, we can't really rely on all the things that we'd taken for granted before. That's a very common cause historically of demand for radical action.
So So it seems there's a shift from internationalism to nationalism.
Yes, I think that's generally right. And one of the things I think we've been seeing in the course of the economic crisis is, on the one hand, lots of statements about how important international cooperation is, but on the other hand, how difficult it is really to get that cooperation in practice, so that the declarations, 20 summit, about the importance of resisting protection, but then the individual politicians go back and they do things to try to protect their domestic markets.
With the advancement of globalization, there's been a diminished role for both the right wing and left wing in terms of the redistribution of wealth by government. Does the diminishment of globalization and that trend bring back that old difference into high relief, with the left wanting to take and redistribute and the right wanting to keep as much as possible?
Yes, I think we're seeing absolutely that. We're much more worried now about the increased inequalities that globalization brought, and we're really prepared to act politically against those inequalities. You see that in country after country, and in part also, I think this is a consequence of just dealing with enormous fiscal burdens that states have suddenly discovered that they're confronted with.
We look back, and you do this very well in The Creation and Destruction of Value. You have an entire chapter on 1929 or 1931, which historical analogy applies. We have the Depression, which turned into the Great Depression in 1931, as it affected institutions all over the globe, triggered trade protectionism and tariffs between formerly open trade partners. What, in your opinion, are the parallels to the Chinese as the emergent industrial giant of our day, as we were in the 1920s and 30s?
Yes, I mean, I think that's a fascinating issue. There's a wonderful book, and it's really, to my mind, still the most influential book on the Great Depression, Charlie Kindleberger's World in Depression. And the analysis of Kindleberger was the world financial system, the world economic system, world political system. It required some kind of hegemon. And in the 19th century, that demand had been supplied by Britain as a hegemon. But in the 1920s and the 1930s, Britain was much weakened by the war, incapable of providing that kind of hegemonic role. And the United States built up an enormous position as the world's leading creditor country, but the United States was not willing to take the responsibilities that went with that creditor role, and American politics were very inward-oriented and very domestically oriented. And the United States actually contributed very little to solving any of the problems of the other countries during the Great Depression. And it seems to me that Kindleberger story is really very easily updated now. The United States still has a very international outlook. In practice, it's like the Britain of the 19th century, but it's no longer a big surplus country. It's a big deficit country. It's reliant on the financing of its deficits by the surpluses that have built up rather surprisingly in relatively poor countries, in emerging market countries, in China above all, but in other Asian countries, and in the Middle East as well. And the question really is whether those emerging countries are going to have the ability and the willingness to stabilize the world economy. And, you know, up to now, I have to say, I think China today has done much better than the United States did in the 1920s and 1930s. And the big Chinese fiscal, the counter-cyclical fiscal stimulus package, 4 trillion renminbi package, was one of the things that really stopped the world slipping into something like the Great Depression in 2009, and has really produced very substantial growth, and maybe even the danger of a new bubble now. So I don't think we're out of the danger, but the danger is actually of a bubble developing in the emerging markets rather than of the collapse in demand in the emerging markets, which would be the equivalent of the collapse of demand in the 1930s in the United States.
Well, speaking of bubbles and asset bubbles, it could be argued that loose monetary policy was largely responsible for the asset bubble of the late 20s. Is it advisable to employ loose monetary policies as the cure for a bursting bubble? Intuitively, it seems that sets you up for the next misallocation of capital or the next major bubble. This is what we discussed last week with Otmar Ising, what he described as an asymmetrical banking policy, where you support on the one hand, but you let go on the other, and don't really keep a cap on asset prices.
Well, yeah, I think he's right on that. I mean, the danger is that we go from one big bubble to another bubble that's even bigger, and each time the bubble collapses, the more devastating it is, because it has a terrible effect on financial institutions. And the collapse of financial institutions, I think if it were just a question of some banks failing on their own, nobody would be worried about it, but they really affect a lot of real activity, and they can do tremendous damage when they collapse. So I think the advice of avoiding serial bubbles is very sound and very important advice, but it's actually hard to implement it in practice, because you get a crisis, everybody shouts, we need to do something about it. And what they do, as in 2008, they inject a lot of liquidity, enormous amounts of liquidity, all the world central banks did that. And quite a lot of really big countries have big fiscal action as well. So the stimulus coming from the monetary side, the stimulus coming from the fiscal side, and it does indeed set the world up for the next asset bubble. And, you know, I think, as I say, that you can see signs of that next asset bubble developing in the emerging markets at the moment. And, you know, what a collapse there would look like would also be quite a frightening prospect.
Just a reminder, you're listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com.
We saw the structure of credit change in the 1930s, and you highlight this in your book. Do you think that the Fed is buying time, hoping the consumer shows up again in force? How long will or can the Fed and Treasury remain the spender of last resort? He has, in 1931, essentially has the structure of credit changed, and with it a lasting wealth effect.
I think one of the problems is that what we had in 2008 in the last quarter, in the aftermath of the AIG collapse, was a sort of world financial heart attack. And the result of that is still with us, that financial institutions, banks, are going to put the emphasis, in part because regulators tell them to do that, but in part also because of their experiences, they're going to put the emphasis on increasing their capitalization. And the easiest, simplest way of doing that is it's hard to raise new capital now, so they're going to cut back on their asset side, and they're going to reduce the amount of credit that they give. So, you know, I think what's happened is that we've seen the central banks step in as creditors and dealers of last resort, stepping in where the banking system failed. In that sense, I don't think this is so much an inflationary danger, but I think it's a problem that is going to be with us really for a very long time. And it has sort of interesting distributional effects as well, because the businesses that tend to be hit hardest by this are small and medium-sized enterprises. Big firms can easily use the capital markets, can issue securities, and those markets are functioning again quite well. It's the small and medium-sized businesses that are having great difficulties, and where I think also some of the great anxieties are building up in a sense of injustice, because they're going to say, why are we paying really very large amounts for bank credit when the central banks are providing credit almost for free to the major financial institutions? It looks very, very unjust. And that, to me, is characteristic of these credit crunches, where people get very, very anxious about credit. They're right to get anxious about credit, and they're very angry about the consequences.
And that's particularly relevant here in the United States, where jobs are dominated by that small and medium-sized enterprise category, 60 to 70% of jobs provided by small business owners.
I mean, it's relevant in the United States. It's relevant in Europe, because in Europe, bank credit plays a much bigger role in the financing of enterprises than it does in the United States. All the big industrial economies really suffer from it.
You discuss both the history of forced bank mergers as well as those from just a short time ago. And looking back a little bit, reviewing history, we had the forced merger of Creditanstalt and Bodenkreditanstalt, which was orchestrated by the government. The primary issue ended up being, after the fact, that the balance sheet was in shambles. Do we have a Creditanstalt in our midst today? We've got the likes of Bank of America, Citigroup, Wells Fargo, which are now having to set aside an additional $30 billion in reserves for home equity losses. There are a lot of bad debts still in the banking system, and our concern is that there might be a similar kind of forced disclosure of balance sheet frailty as there was with Creditanstalt if the FASB rules are resurrected, or if there's additional regulatory reforms or disclosures of off-balance sheet entities required. And it looks as if derivative regulation is on the horizon. So what does it look like for these banking entities, the forced mergers of the last year or two, to sort of give up the ghost on information relating to Level 3 assets and things that, just like Bodenkreditanstalt, would be considered the bad debt category.
Yes, I see that parallel as well. I'm worried by exactly that. In a sense, we've got a kind of big irony in that we thought that oversized financial institutions that behaved irresponsibly because they thought that they were too big to fail or too complex to fail, they were part of the cause of the crisis. What we do in the crisis is to make financial institutions even bigger. I'm not quite sure that I see the exact parallels with the Kreditanstalt, because at least for the moment, because what happened was that Austria was a very, very small country, and it was really completely overwhelmed by the debts of this banking system. The United States is much larger and has a much greater borrowing capacity, even now with enormous fiscal deficits. And in crisis situations, the United States is in a really quite unique position. It's the borrower of last resort. It's still the most stable country in the world. So, you know, I think the United States is capable of handling these very big banks. But I believe the reaction to those sort of problems are going to be, again, in a really rather political sense, we're going to complain about the way that it's done, see all kinds of political corruption in the way that these things are worked out in practice, and injustices in terms of the way the credit is allocated by these mega institutions. So the United States can rescue the banks in a way that I think Austria in 1931 really couldn't. But on the other hand, it's going to produce the same sort of reactions. And that, again, is something that would worry me.
In the 1931 crisis, and today as well, there's an important geopolitical component. Democracy makes navigating in an international crisis more difficult. Maybe you can explore this idea a bit. It's the constituency-driven nature of democracy and choices that leadership may make, which don't always render an immediate solution, which may be at issue. Democratically elected politicians have a short time slice in which to enact policies and achieve results, or re-election is out of the question. How do you take a long view in implementing policies? Again, maybe you can explore the geopolitical dimensions of the current crisis.
Yes, I think this goes back to this earlier conversation we were having about the analogies with the Great Depression, and the analogies in particular between the role of the United States then and the role of China and other big emerging markets today. And one of the big differences is clearly that China is not a democracy. And in some ways, this makes it easier for the Chinese leadership to take a longer-term view. But on the other hand, it also means that the Chinese leadership is very, very worried about things that might threaten its legitimacy, because the fact that there aren't elections in China doesn't mean that the Chinese government isn't sensible to what goes on in the streets and in big cities and also in the villages in rural China. And there's a kind of terror of what might happen if there isn't a constant rate of growth. So one of the things that pushed this big fiscal stimulus package was the sense that unless there's a big stimulus, there would be a rise in unemployment, and the unemployed would be very violent and would threaten the stability of the regime. I think even in a non-democracy, you have a kind of way in which the regime is sensitive to the demands of people. And it's also something that I think enters into the current equation. Now, when you come to the question of how democracies deal with it, well, there I think the pressure to be protectionist is really quite substantial. And it's really a classic answer of democracies in depressions. That's what they tend to do. And I do think we're seeing some of that happening at the moment.
Well, different than most of the crises in the 19th and 20th centuries, the starting point this time was in developed countries versus developing countries, some of the most powerful of the G8. You review the weekend meetings in your book where the world's central bankers and fiscal authorities were behind closed doors with the financial elite, quote, saving capitalism from itself. Is their success enduring?
I think they really had a moment when it looked as if it was all going to fail. And, you know, I think you raised the question of the impact of democracy and the impact of elections. I think one of the reasons why the Lehman story was so severe and why it was really so mishandled was the short space of time between the September 2008 and the elections in November 2008. And it really produced a kind of paralysis in dealing with the situation, that it meant that, you know, on the one hand, the feeling was that the Democrats looking at this didn't want to hand nice triumph over to the Republicans. And on the other hand, that the Republicans mean, I wonder whether if you'd had something like the Lehman collapse a long way away from any election, there wouldn't have been a better and more efficient solution of it and a less damaging solution of it.
There's an interesting tie-in here on the political, wherein the Lehman crisis might not have been as bad, or it might have looked quite different had there not been an election on the horizon. Mm-hmm. And so, as we see, there is this link between politics and finance, between economics and politics and finance. And there's in the news still pressing the issue of how to solve the Greek problem.
Right.
You have local politics, you have European politics, you have a specific financial crisis which has to be solved, and now the comparison is being made with the Greece situation, and it's being said that this is exactly like Lehman all over. We either bail them out or we bring the world to its knees. Kevin, we started the conversation with Harold James, and we're going to have the second half of this conversation continued next week, and we'll look at several issues. We'll look at, in more detail, the weekends of 2008, which made history. We'll look at the extent and limitation of the financial revolution, and we'll also look at the importance of values, a return to values on Wall Street, sorely needed, a return to an understanding of values culturally as they disintegrate under the weight of globalization coming unbound. And there is some time, I think, we'll spend, too, looking at the end of globalization. That is what is being argued is at stake. Is this a natural cycle? Does this happen? Is it inevitable? Is there anything that we can do individually, or that central planners, whether it's central bankers or politicians, could do or could have done to have prevented this from occurring? This will be part of our conversation next week as we continue discussing these things with Harold James. Again, Kevin, we come back to the Greek issue.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, it's interesting. Ambrose Evans Pritchard, a regular guest on this program who writes for the London Telegraph, has been talking about how Lehman, he keeps bringing Lehman up, even though that's a 2-year-old issue, roughly, because Greece is being tied in as the Lehman of Europe. And there are predictions right now that unless something radical happens to bail Greece out, you're going to see some sort of worldwide or at least European catastrophe.
Now, as we saw in that crisis where Lehman was allowed to fail, that wasn't the end of the story. It was the beginning of the story.
Yeah.
And that's a part of what we'll cover next week with Harold James. It was the beginning of the story because it was the beginning of shotgun weddings amongst all your other financial institutions. If your balance sheet was at all weak, something had to change, namely ownership.
Right.
And so the institution that was is no longer the institution that now is.
There was a consolidation into basically a consolidation of power.
Right. But how do you do that when you're talking about politics and not just individual entities that buy and sell for $10, $20, $50 a share?
Right.
You can't do that with Portugal. It's not for sale.
Right.
You can't do that with Italy. It's not for sale. You can't do that with Spain. You can't do that with Ireland. So while there are some analogies to Lehman, it actually is quite different in terms of the implications of the response, because it's not simply a bailout at a financial level. This has ramifications into politics, European politics, global politics. Boy, I tell you, what a fascinating time to be alive.
Well, you know, David, it is a fascinating time to be alive. We talked about the weekends that made history before he wrote this book. I mean, we would talk during the program for those listeners who were listening 2 years ago. We were scratching our heads saying, gosh, look at all the decisions that are being made on the weekend. They're changing our life here in America.
Didn't we call one of those programs Robbing Peter to Pay Paulson?
I think we did. Now, David, I've got a question for you, though. Okay, there was a consolidation of corporate power here in America, or banking power, you know, crisis used to consolidate, just like in 1907, J.P. Morgan, 1908. Are we looking at the potential of consolidation of political power in Europe with all these crises being raised up to the Lehman level? The answer, and Ottmar Issing, you know, we talked about it before, he sees the European Union, or the EMU, basically, as a financial union, but not necessarily a political union. Is that the direction they're going?
Dissolution or consolidation? Those seem to be the two clearest options. Consolidation, I think, is led by the country that has the greatest balance sheet. They have the loudest voice, the greatest influence, and the ability to call the shots because they have actually the most at stake as well. Does Germany emerge from this as a reborn powerhouse? Very likely. The alternative is they can walk away from this project.
Right.
Is their face lost in the process? Is there an embarrassment? Is there major restructuring that occurs? What do politics look like in the context of no euro and no EMU.
Well, you know, David, we've talked about how these things almost always require some sort of collective answer, even though that actually destroys the free market. You know, one of the things that we wanted to bring out with Harold James is what Harold James is defining as globalism, or globalization, rather, is the free flow of money, people, and goods around the world. But he believes that collective answers or collectivism actually destroys that globalization. So we're not talking about some sort of New World Order author here. We're talking about a man who says, actually, when you have a collective answer or a consolidation of power, you're shutting down globalization.
Kevin, this goes back to a cycle which is very similar to what we see in the stock market, wherein you have periods where trust builds, and there's greater efficiency in the marketplace, and there's growth, and there's mergers and acquisitions which are accretive, and everyone's happy, everyone's making money. Mm-hmm. But it's defined by an underlying truth, and that is that there is trust underlying the whole system. When trust begins to break down, you see the exact opposite happen. People want to hold on to their capital. People get very stodgy about doing investment deals. It ends up being an environment like globalization in fast forward, now, in fact, in reverse, mm-hmm. where you focus more on your own personal interests rather than anyone else's.
Pure protectionism, regulation, and collectivism. Well, you know, should we maybe continue the program next week in where the regulation may go, and how that'll affect the globalization process or the anti-globalization process.
And perhaps with some focus again on Europe.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Harold James. We'll continue the conversation next week with Harold James. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or just give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.